You're listening to the Reading Envy podcast, where I'll have what you're reading. Hi, everyone. This is Jenny, and you have reached the Reading Envy podcast, where we'll have what you're reading. I have a guest who has driven down from Minnesota.
Well, I didn't drive from Minnesota. I drove from Tryon, but I flew from Minnesota.
Yeah. So Sarah Till. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
And so she knew she'd be in the area, and we decided to do this in person. So that's fun. We're actually in my office. So Sarah, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you? Why do you listen to podcasts?
That's a good question, podcast. I'm a big reader, and I seem to be always surrounding myself with words. So I also write. And so I'd love to listen to podcasts just because it keeps me company while I do other stuff. But it's also a great way for me to suck in knowledge. I find that I retain a lot more when I'm listening than when I'm reading. Mm-hmm. And as I get older, my retention for reading has just like completely disappeared. So I found your podcast, though, through Goodreads. Mm-hmm. And I just am always craving recommendations for new books to read or books that I've already read to reconsider. A lot of the book podcasts that I listen to are all about new books or popular books I'm not really interested in reading. It just drives me crazy how popular books overshadow books that really are much more worth reading. And so even on Jeopardy last night or two nights ago, there was like a books column. There probably always is. I don't watch it that often, but my parents were like, oh, Sarah, you'll know all the answers to this. But all the questions were about books I've never read because they're like popular books that I'm not really interested in.
Yeah. Like the ones you buy at Target or.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The ones on the bestseller list. Mm. So yeah. So I'm interested in more of a deep dive into really good writing.
So what kind of books really pull you in?
I mostly read fiction. I love a good story, but I don't like detective novels and I don't like mysteries and or true crime. I'd like or crime novels. I like a good story and also a writer who has the confidence to have like a point of view about the world, like to create like a vision of the world or just an opinion about how the world works, that the writing kind of stems from that. So there aren't that many writers that actually do that. They're usually bigger books. I often find myself dissatisfied with books that I read because I'm expecting a lot from a book, but there needs to be some authority in the writing. And I don't like a lot of experimental fiction. I should probably like it more, but I'm just not as interested. I think as I get older, I'm more interested in just something that I want it that keeps me reading because I'm curious about it.
Well, what's a good example of someone who does what you're talking about?
I was trying to think of one. I know I was sitting here blathering that I should come up with one. The one I can always pull out of my hat is Angle of Repose by Wallace Stegner.
Ah.
Because he wrote this history of the discovery of the West, but it was told through characters' eyes. And so it felt intimate. It also felt authoritative. It felt fully realized, fully imagined. And it's very kind of far reaching. A lot of the books that I've loved are Pulitzer Prize winning books. I just think the Pulitzer tends to understand.
Interesting.
I know, isn't that weird? Like James Smiley, I loved A Thousand Acres. Just someone who kind of has an idea about how, in Pulitzer's situation, it's usually America, how America operates and what it's like to be living in America in any part of the country's history. They tend to be longer books, a little more involved. But every once in a while, I'll read a shorter book that's much more limited in perspective and much more limited in terms of characters and story, and it'll blow me away.
So it kind of makes it sound like there's no one way to find those books then, since it's not genre-based.
Exactly.
You have to like really dig.
You really need to dig, yeah. And I can often tell in the first chapter or so if I'm going to like this.
And do you bail on them?
I feel really bad about bailing. The more stars it gets on Goodreads, the more tentative I am about bailing. But I'm not, as I get older, I'm not like,
life's too short.
Life's too short.
And you said before we started recording that you used to work at Penguin.
Penguin, yeah.
Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, it was, some time ago. It was, they wouldn't employ me now. I'm I've aged myself out of it. I started out working as a production editor there. So I was in like their managing editor's office. And then I started working in their marketing department, their academic marketing. At the time, you know, people were reading books and not downloading them. So we would have to go to academic conferences all over the country and peddle our books. So the books that I was really paying attention to in marketing were the ones that I would actually read because they were like the classics or really good nonfiction. And and that was really fun. And then I left for a while and then I came back. And when I came back, I was working for Viking. Well, Viking and Penguin, but it was a little more segregated. And I did advertising for them. So I was, by the time I left, I was the assistant advertising director there, which was, it sounds impressive, but really our budget was like $1 million and 600,000 of it was spent on Stephen King.
Right. Because you put your big money behind the books that are going to sell.
Exactly. And then, and that was when Barnes and Noble, like that's when the independent bookstores were starting to disappear. And like Barnes and Noble was before Amazon.
Right. It's like the Borders, Barnes and Noble
exactly.
Wars.
Exactly. The Waterstone. Yeah. Those books were like eating everyone's advertising money and a lot of the promotional efforts and stuff. So, you know, you see really good books just get completely passed over.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating.
And still happens now.
Oh, I'm sure it does. For sure, yeah. Now you can't even get them published, you know?
Yeah, I had a guest just a few episodes ago who was talking about the difficulty of being a novelist with a sophomore novel and trying to get it published.
It's just a guy who has his own imprint now. Yeah. Like well, because he said, I was listening to him because he said, I'm a mid-list author. Like, right. That's a death knell.
I know. That's awful because it's also a success. Like it means you've published a book.
Right. But also, like, that's where the really good books are. Because probably. It takes some work to read. And
Yeah. So we just need to dedicate ourselves to that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe a mid-list book club or something.
Well, I feel like, you know, in Minnesota or in Minneapolis where I live, there's Milkweed and there's Grey Wolf.
Yes.
And Coffee House.
Yes.
And they're all doing amazing stuff. I almost brought Milkman here to talk about because Milkweed published that in America. And I was so happy about that. But, you know, and they've got two of the National Book Award nominees on their list. Don't ask me what they are. I can't remember. But Machado, is it maybe?
Yeah,
are
Machado.
They doing Machados?
I have that on my pile at home. I haven't gotten to it yet, but it's like right there.
I'm meeting her on Monday. She's coming to Minneapolis to read. So I'm going to go and work at the reading. But
I saw her at AWP and the room was just packed.
It's there were really
people
exciting.
Like lining the walls and sitting on the floor. And she's a good speaker, a good reader too.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading her book. I haven't read anything by her, so.
I subscribe to Grey Wolf. Like, I don't remember what they call it. Grey Wolf Galley Club or something like that. Uh-huh. So I get some occasional books from them. And they're not necessarily, or hardly ever, the really popular books.
Oh, no.
It's like
the ones that they send you?
Yeah, the ones I get. It's like a book of poetry I wouldn't have heard of.
Right.
Right now, there's like a kind of a scary book. Yeah, it's neat. I love our little small presses. And to have three in town is...
Well, we also have the University of Minnesota Press, which just started doing fiction.
Oh, really?
Weren't. Yeah. And the managing editor is a friend of mine. And we had dinner a couple weeks ago, and she brought me a whole stack of books. And nice. Because of Milkweed and Grey Wolf's success with publishing books in translation, now they're starting to really pay attention to that. Wow. So that's exciting.
So you said that you're in a few book clubs, too.
Like, yes.
Tell me about those.
One book club I'm in... It's now our 24th year.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's just people who are friends. So we met in a neighborhood and then some of the people went to school together. It was a big St. Olaf contingent.
Oh, yeah.
But we've managed to keep it going, which is really, we've only had a couple people drop out and then, you know, switch in. The four of us that are the original members have been there for 24 years. And unfortunately... The reading has become secondary to the getting together because, you know, you get like a family and you get busy and then you have a job and you're busy with that. So you don't get to see these people. And then you also don't try and see them because you know you're going to see them at book club. So
right.
It becomes like a social thing. So I started another one with a friend of mine. We had a litmus test. If you liked The Prince of Tides, you could not be in the book club. So... And we've been going for maybe 5 years. And that's much more, we talk much more about the books in that one.
Where do you meet? Like in homes?
Oh, we meet in each other. Yeah, homes.
I always wondered if that dynamic made a difference too.
Like, oh, I think so. Yeah. Well, because also I hate having people in my house. It's so messy. It's such a pain to like clean up and get ready for people. But I love talking, and I love sharing, you know, I love cooking. And for one book club, it's dinner and wine. For the other book club, it's just snacks. It's not as big a deal, but it becomes a hassle. That shouldn't be the thing that you're paying attention to.
Right.
It should just be the books.
Because my book club meets at a restaurant.
Oh, okay.
And so
is there like ordering and like,
yeah, so you can interrupt it all the time like that. And then the person checking back in, 30, the people that come late.
30 people at a restaurant?
Well, it's usually like 18 to 23.
But still, how do you?
We have this place now. It's like an oyster restaurant, and there's this back room that they let us use.
Okay. Is it one table?
It's one long table.
Oh my goodness.
Conversations can be hard.
Yeah, you'd have to like yell down to the table to get.
We've tried so many other places. There's a coffee place. And for one thing, there just wasn't enough space for us. And it always felt like they wanted us to leave.
Right.
And
right.
You just couldn't hear anyone.
No, I'm sure.
And we had a restaurant that was like a deli, and they were willing for us to be there and stay there, but everything was wooden. And so everyone's voice echoed. And we were so loud because we were like really loud.
So, I don't know, Jenny. That sounds like you need an intervention of some sort.
I know. I've tried suggesting let's break up into smaller, or even like once you all get there, like meet around smaller tables or something.
Yeah.
I think everyone just wants to be in the main group, so I might have to start my own book club like you have done. I probably wouldn't leave that one though, because I've been in it for several years.
Well, that's the thing. It's really hard to stop that.
Yeah, and I really appreciate those women. It's mostly women. It's one guy. Maybe two guys, but they're all kind of affiliated with our international center. And so we intentionally read books about other places, which I really like.
Yeah. Yep.
So, and they are actually committed to reading and talking about the books.
Right. Right.
You have to give it to them for that.
Yeah. So. Well, I think that's like, if you don't have that and you have a big room with 30 people, then like, there's not much else going on then.
No. And one person chit-chat. Always like does research and presents it. So. It's pretty serious.
Is serious. But we've tried to do that. We've tried to like, sometimes the meal is like German, if it's a book about Germany, or like, you know, have like some kind of visual aid, but you know, it doesn't always work that well.
If at least you can talk about the book, then it feels like you've accomplished
exactly.
Prince of Tides makes me laugh though, because around here that might be blasphemy.
I know. I just realized that as I was saying that, like, who am I offending by saying that? I mean, I like the Great Santini, but I just thought he was trying too hard to be Faulkner, and he's not Faulkner.
I have not read that particular one yet. Maybe someday. There's a lot of repeated themes in Conroy's work, so it kind of feels like once you've read one, it's like you've kind of read the other.
Oh yeah, I guess you're right. I don't know. He wrote Stop Time, didn't he? That's his autobiography.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. I read that in my writing class a long time ago. I also took. I'm a fiction writer. I should probably just say that, but not a very successful one. And so I took a great class when I was living in New York. It was a craft class. And so we read a book each week, and then we would use it as to learn our technique, our narrative technique.
Yeah.
And so Stop Time was one of the books we read for that.
Oh, cool. So what did you learn from Pat Conroy?
Honestly, I don't remember. In that class, and it was taught by this poet named Philip Schultz, who had a measure of success after I left New York. So I was bummed about that, because he was more struggling when we were and he was teaching the class. But we read this book by Nicholson Baker called Mezzanine.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read his stuff?
Oh, yeah.
So he's in like a...
Escalator.
He's in an escalator. He's going to... He leaves for lunch hour to buy shoelaces, and then he goes back. And it's all about that. And it's just this discourse on just life in modern times. And I loved it. I got very moved by it. So later when I moved to Minneapolis, and I remember my teacher, Phil, saying, well, that book really spoke to you. I can tell you were really, like, it got to you. I'm like, yeah, I don't know why. I really connected with it. Later we moved to Minneapolis, and he came to speak to do a reading. I asked him this question about Mezzanine, about whether he was using the details of his life to kind of ward off the intensity of the emotion, like he was trying to deflect so that you could indirectly experience the trauma of just being a middle-aged man in America. And he was like, no.
He's a little cranky.
I was like, okay, I got that wrong. I mean, I completely got it wrong. According to him, I don't believe that's the right answer.
Maybe he didn't like to feel known.
Well, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
He just shut me down completely. So have you met him?
No, No, I make a lot of assumptions based on his writing.
Well, he's kind of a cranky writer.
Well, and because he took librarians on, you know.
Oh, that's right.
That's how I got introduced to him, is I read Double-Fold, The Assault of Libraries on Paper, I think is the subtitle.
Right.
And some of the stuff in there he got right. And some of it he just flat out got wrong, you know.
Interesting.
But it was interesting. And he, you know, he opened his own little library warehouse thing where he saved a whole bunch of newspapers at one of those schools.
I haven't read that book, but I remember that story.
Yeah. So I went back and read some of his older stuff based on the urgings of a friend, and that was interesting. Like, I remember Mezzanine, Fermata, Vox. I read all those.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I always buy them when I see them, and then I realize I have them already. And then there's a few I haven't liked so much, like the one that's kind of like Mezzanine, but it's all the thoughts he has when he's, like, rocking a baby.
Yeah, that's his first book.
Okay.
Or I don't know if it was his first, but it came before Mezzanine. Yeah.
I didn't care for that one as much, but I really liked the one about the poet.
I'm not sure I remember that one.
I know either. Traveling Sprinkler is the follow-up to it.
You know, I stopped reading him after he shut me down.
Oh, yeah. He should have thought of that.
Well, I just felt like I totally didn't get, why would I read him if I can't even understand, like if I don't get it? But Vox came out when I was working at Viking.
Ah.
And it was a big deal because it's so dirty.
It's really dirty.
And it came in like a black jacket. Like it had to be like a big secret.
Yeah.
And it was outrageous. And
that's the phone sex one.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Which now it just seems like
now it's really
no
quaint.
Big deal. I know.
The one I was thinking of is The Anthologist.
Oh, okay.
And it's about this man who, his name is Paul Chowder, and he sits in his white plastic chair on his driveway all the time, but he's making an anthology of rhymed poetry.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
And I was so intrigued by this idea that I went through and I made an index of the poets that are mentioned, because I felt like obviously what you would want to do after reading the novel is read the poetry.
Exactly.
And like, how could they not provide an index? So I made one. So like that, I've read because of that Sarah Teasdale, who I'd never heard of before,
and
like
great.
Other poets like that, you know,
cool.
Which are wonderful. So
wow,
yeah, I'll have to
pick that one up.
But not everything he's written has worked for me. You know, it kind of comes and goes. I tried reading his memoir about being a substitute teacher, and I just couldn't get into that one. So that was much more recent, I think. He does come across as at least he has a point of view, right?
Like it's exactly right.
It's strong. Well, what was the last book that you read in your book clubs? Just to give us an idea, do you remember?
Oh, yeah, it was this book, The Gloaming.
Oh, good.
That I brought.
But we did each bring books to talk about today.
Yes.
So did you want to start in on that?
Yeah. The first book is The Gloaming by Melanie Finn. And this was published in the UK and barely published in this country, even though she's American, which I thought was very interesting. It was shortlisted for The Guardian's Not the Booker Prize in 2015, which I guess is a claim to fame, it sounds like.
Yeah. It's from $2 Radio, though, right?
Yeah. But so they picked it up. I don't know. I mean, I found it in a half-price bookstore, and it looked interesting to me. But anyway, it is. Have you heard of it?
Just because I follow $2 Radio, but I haven't read
this
particular book.
I think it's fabulous. It's about a woman who is American, but she's living in Austria, Switzerland? Well, she's somewhere in Europe, Geneva. She finds out that her husband is having an affair, and her husband is a human rights attorney, and they have traveled in their career all over mostly Africa. She's been his helpmeet, and she's this beautiful young woman, and you know, they fell in love immediately. And so she finds out when living in Geneva that he's having an affair, and he leaves her. In her shock, and she's trying to deal with this, she drives her car into three children at a bus stop and kills them all.
Oh, no.
And so then she is basically like run out of town. People mutter things to her in town. And so she escapes to Tanzania, which she knows Africa, or she knows parts of the continent of Africa pretty well. So she escapes to this little tiny village in Tanzania. And the book is following her from place to place in Africa as she is, I don't know, on this kind of mission of like redemption, I would call it. Although you don't really get that sense until after the book that that's what she was trying to do. I loved it because it reveals the story very gradually. So you're kind of plopped into the middle of these different places and you have to kind of piece together what happened, which can be annoying, but I think she does it really, really well. And also her description is just incredible. I like really good writing. So this is a from the point of view of another one of the characters. Some of the chapters are different characters that are part of her story. So this guy says, "Let us find relief in obscurity and this still quiet strip of potholes hemming a continent, defining the end of something and the beginning of something else." And then she also talks, another character says to her, "Life is full of sorrow and shittiness, but it's what you make of it. What have you made of it? What have you done? Have you done anything good? Anything beautiful? Have you created anything? Music? Art? Have you made anything better, even in a small way? A small light in this dark world? Have you ever been happy?" I don't know. I just think there's some surprising language. Here's her description of the gloaming. Do you know what the gloaming is? Mm-mm. It's a time of day. It's twilight, basically. It's okay. When, like, day ends and becomes evening and the sky gets that purple glow sometimes. Mm. "We stand in the gloaming. The late evening light, soft and translucent, has made the world benign. The house is white and round and sheltered by red blooming tulip trees. 100 yards from the door, a low sandy cliff dips to the sea in a swarm of mangroves. White egrets flock to roost. The sun slips behind the mangroves, creating spangles and diamonds through the leaves. The air vibrates with the wild looping song of bulbul birds."
Ah, that's beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
There's a lot of brutality in this book, and usually I can't handle that, but it didn't bother me in this one at all.
Hmm. I wonder if this author's written anything else. It's not really a name that's familiar to me.
I know. Her first novel, Away From You, was published in 2004 to international acclaim. Yeah, and then she's also a filmmaker. She's like one of these people who's like raised in Kenya, lived in Connecticut,
yeah,
worked as a freelance journalist, like, made a wealth.
Leads creativity.
Yeah, look at her. She's beautiful too.
Of course.
So like, yeah. Now lives on a hill in Vermont.
Wow. And see you got it from Half Price Books, which is a store from the Midwest that I miss.
Oh, really? Is that a Midwestern store?
I think so, because in Indiana we had them too. Yeah.
Oh, are you think from Indiana?
No, I just was there half, you know, in the middle of my life.
Oh, so. Okay.
Grad school, you know.
Okay. So what do you have?
Well, I think I'm going to start with an older book that I read because it was on my TBR Explode project, which I've talked about several times, but basically I'm going back through my project.
I love that yeah. You're like getting rid of all these books.
Yeah. And I didn't want to just delete them.
Right.
And I just want to like revisit them and decide if I should still read them. And every once in a while I get into one where it's just easy to finish it. And so I do.
Uh-huh.
So I read The Blue Castle by L.M. Montgomery, and that's the author of Anne of Green Gables, but it was a book I hadn't heard of. It's a standalone. And it's about this woman. Her name is Yancey Sterling and she's 29. She's unmarried, much to the chagrin of her family. They think that she should be, and they all have dinner together every night. So it's like her mother, her aunt, her uncle, you know, it's just like an extended group, mm-hmm. all that same age. Mm-hmm. And she's always the butt of their jokes. And they're always telling her that she's not good enough in a variety of ways. They have the same conversations every night. And she's so bored. She's just so bored. And they don't think that reading even is something that one should do, except for on Sundays. And so
but where does it take place?
I think it's the countryside in Ontario.
Is that PEI?
No, okay. It's more like inland.
Okay.
And so like she can't even sit and read all day to uh-huh. like keep her mind busy. And so she's just bored all the time.
Yeah.
And so she gets this medical diagnosis that makes her think that her life is going to be short. And so she decides, to heck with this, I'm going to take my life into my own hands. And so she does. And she moves out and she lives on her own terms. I have a few little quotes that I just think are so powerful. Now, keep in mind, this is from 1926. I'm going to kind of ruin the book because this is the conclusion.
And spoiler alert.
"I've been trying to please other people all my life and failed. After this, I shall please myself. I shall never pretend anything again. I've breathed an atmosphere of fibs and pretenses and evasions all my life. What a luxury it will be to tell the truth. I may not be able to do much that I want to do, but I won't do another thing I don't want to do. Mother can pout for weeks. I shan't worry over it. Despair is a free man. Hope is a slave."
Despair is a free man. Hope is a slave.
And she's quoting someone else.
There, okay.
But I'm not sure who. And the very first quote I put in my review when I wrote it, which I think is around from that same page, "It was so easy to defy once you got started." And so she ends up making new friends, people who are like not approved right. by the town
like
elders.
Free spirits yes. and bohemians. Yeah.
And so this very interesting man who lives on this island, and I won't say much more because that's really the whole plot of the story. Mm-hmm. But I was just so charmed by it because we all need these role models in our lives.
Absolutely.
Of like people taking control of their own lives. And here's one from 1926.
Do you know how it was received when it was published?
I don't. I didn't really look into that, but I got the sense that it was somewhat autobiographical.
Right.
Because she has a lot of characters that are like that in the end.
Yeah.
There's this other part that's so funny because she intentionally offended her mother because every time she offended her mother, she'd stop speaking to her for a few days. In the beginning, like for most of her life, that was used as this manipulative tool. But then she decided, I can use that for my advantage because if I offend her, she'll stop talking to me and I can just go live my life. I was like, that's how you need to think about it. So it doesn't feel as old as the book is.
Right.
You know, at all. So it's very fun to read. Makes me want to go back and read all the other L.M. Montgomery books I haven't read because all I've ever read is Anne of Green Gables.
Right. Well, I was going to say, like, I don't even know that she wrote anything else. I mean, that's my...
There are so many more standalone novels than I ever really understood. Mm-hmm. And some of them are for adults and some of them are for younger people.
Okay.
And then there's like Emily of New Moon, which is another series.
Oh, okay.
And God, I don't even know what that one's about.
So, okay.
Yeah. Wow. She's very prolific. And that's like pre-World War One, I think. It was published in 1926, but right. It's set before World War One.
Right. I keep thinking it's like right before the war though. Like, isn't it 1915, 16, 17? I don't know. I don't remember now.
I'm really bad at remembering. Yeah, if it's a time of peace, at least when the novel was set. So
was Canada in World War One?
I took English history.
Yeah, I know exactly.
Not even American.
I'm not
history.
Supposed to know that. I don't know that.
Yes,
picked up the crown. So right,
they played a prominent part. Yeah, I guess technically, yeah, it's a British Empire. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm enjoying my little project of going back to these books that I always meant to read, and clearly this was for a reason.
Uh-huh.
I don't have much more to say about it though. It's a pretty quick read. I probably read it in an afternoon.
Uh-huh. Oh, really? Okay. Well, you seem to read very fast.
I do read fast, but that one was really fast. So what else do you have?
So I have West with the Night by Beryl Markham, which is, it has an interesting publishing history. It's a kind of a really well-known book. Have you heard of it?
I've heard of the person, but I'm not sure I've heard of it.
So Beryl Markham was an aviatrix, among other things. That's what she's known for. She was the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic, I believe, in one stop. And maybe the first person to do it. I don't know. But that's where the title comes from, because she was flying from Africa to America. Mm. So she was flying west with the night. And so this is like one of the, I think she's only written like one other thing. I might be wrong about that. So you might have to fact check me. But this was written around the same time that Isaac Dinesen wrote Out of Africa. So the two books are often, I don't know if they're compared, but people have usually read one or the other. I mean, Isaac Dinesen's book is much more popular, but I think this one just blows it away. So this is a memoir. It's kind of like three or four central stories that she's tied together. But she grew up in Kenya on her father's farm. Then her father lost all his money. I mean, she really did grow up with, like, her friends were other children from the tribes that were surrounding the farm. And her father lost money, and so she had to go out on her own, and she became a horse trainer and had a very successful career with that. And then, like, I think lost all her money and then became an aviatrix. So the book borrows from each of those parts of her life. And there's one incident where she is mauled by a lion. I mean, she really has, like, these incredible adventures. It opens with her trying to rescue some guy in the bush. But the thing that really sold it for me is, again, the writing is just amazing. She's flying over the Serengeti. As the herd moved, it became a carpet of rust brown and gray and dull red. It was not like a herd of cattle or sheep because it was wild, and it carried with it the stamp of wilderness and the freedom of a land still more a possession of nature than of men. To see 10,000 animals untamed and not branded with the symbols of human commerce is like scaling an unconquered mountain for the first time, or like finding a forest without roads or footpaths, or the blemish of an axe. You know then what you have always been told, that the world once lived and grew without adding machines and newsprint and brick-walled streets and the tyranny of clocks. So the quote on the book is from Hemingway, who apparently couldn't believe that this woman wrote so much better than he did. He says, written so well and marvelously well that I was completely ashamed of myself as a writer. Markham can write rings around all of us who consider ourselves as writers. It really is a bloody wonderful book. Wow. So it's just a great read. She's a great storyteller.
I think a few years ago, there's a book, maybe a novel about her. Does that ring a bell? Because I feel like I have a book at home that I haven't read yet. That
no, there should be. Like... I mean, she kind of died penniless in Africa. She was kind of a drunk, I think. This book was published and then disappeared. And in the 1980s, I was working at a bookstore in Soho. And North Point Press, which was like one of the first like small presses to kind of make it big, printed, reissued this book, and it became a huge bestseller. So that was like 1984 or 5.
I think the one I'm thinking of is Circling the Sun by Paula McLean, but I'm pretty sure.
Is that about her? I would make, yeah, it probably is. Oh, because she had affairs with both of the men that Isaac Dinesen was involved in.
Oh, interesting. So they had more connections than just writing the book.
Well, no, absolutely. Brobliksen, yeah. And then I forget the name of the guy that she, the Robert Redford character.
Well, I feel like I had either bought the book, this novel about her,
okay,
or someone had bought it for me like in a book swap. I kept hearing, but her memoir is better. Just read her memoir.
Okay.
And I can understand now why. I mean, that writing is incredible.
Yeah.
It also makes me think of one of my books I read for Alaska last year, the Being Caribou one, that described that experience of being in this herd of animals that are completely wild, doing what wild animals do. And it's very, like, yeah, reminiscent of that. It's interesting. So far, two books have had African ties.
Oh, that's interesting. You're right. That is interesting. And
it's not an intentional theme or anything?
Not at all. In fact, you just revealed that to me. I wasn't conscious of that. Huh. I think I do love learning about a place through writing. And definitely. I mean, my daughter has spent some time in Senegal, and she says, you can't just say Africa, Mom. You have to, like, it's not just a continent. Like, yeah, it's a bunch of countries. So, and they're all different. The idea of Africa is very interesting to me. Yeah.
My sister's been to Kenya because growing up, my mom was always a missions coordinator. Oh. And so I used to write letters to a pen pal in Kenya at Rift Valley Academy because she had to go to boarding school on those like airmail.
Oh, the blue crinkly one? Yeah.
And because we were around the same age, and we wrote, because like I think from like fourth grade on, we wrote these letters. Just amazing.
That's great.
But they were more in like the middle of the country. And then we had other friends that were in Turkana land, which I think is in the north. It's a little bit more bushy.
Yeah, I don't.
But this is more like, what's the era? Like 30s, 40s?
This takes place in the 20s, kind of late teens to early 30s, I think.
Okay.
Because she's talking about what's happening in Europe and the rise of Nazism.
Okay, so it's just starting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I really need to read that one for sure.
I think it's an important book to read just because it's just kind of a classic woman's tale.
Yeah, I think we have a strong woman theme today too.
Yeah.
But one always should. There's so many books that fit that theme. I'm being indecisive today. What should I talk about? I think I'll talk about Unfollow.
Okay.
The full title for Unfollow is A Memoir of Loving and Leaving the Westboro Baptist Church by Megan Phelps Roper. And yeah, so it's that church. This is a church that protests at military funerals and says terrible things on their signs. I learned in this book, they actually rewrite popular songs to have hateful song lyrics and then sing them at the top of their lungs, which I've never gone to one of their rallies, so I wouldn't know. But Megan Phelps Roper is the granddaughter of the guy who founded the church.
Fred Phelps.
And so she was in it from her birth. And at the age of 5, she started protesting and being indoctrinated, of course, because her mother was like his right-hand man. She did a lot of the marketing and a lot of the maneuvering of some of the parts for a long time until all of a sudden she was persona non grata, which is an interesting phase in that church. I'm always interested in extreme religion because I was kind of raised in an extreme version of Christianity, not quite as extreme as this. we weren't in one insular community, but there's still kind of the same strategies employed, especially with teaching people this martyr complex that does this really interesting thing, like where if people disagree with you or people get mad at you, then you're doing it right.
Oh, interesting.
So it reinforces the behavior.
Absolutely.
And so I think you really get an insight into that in this
book. That's why they're just so indefatigable.
Yeah, and they're so joyful about it.
Yes.
Because that just proves.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there's this interesting twist on the concept of love, which is in Christianity, but it's like, because we love everyone, we're telling them how they're wrong. So the logic is crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. But it's very self-serving.
It is. And she does such a good job at explaining it in a way that I think a lot of people don't understand it.
Right.
And so she's able to show how every pressure they feel just perpetuates grows the community.
It's really hard to battle that.
Yeah, it's amazing. But she also shows how she left it, which I think is actually gives some clues for like how we could approach people like that.
Yeah,
it's just people who couldn't get riled up, who would like point to the logical fallacies. And the way that she really got communicated to from people on the outside was helping her see how her own beliefs were inconsistent. You know, the beliefs she was told she had, basically.
Right.
Like places where the church had said one thing, but then they did this other thing that conflicted.
Right.
And then she could, once she could start seeing that, then everything could unravel. But until she could see that, it wasn't going to be enough that she was causing harm or that people didn't deserve it or that there's more than one perspective. Like none of that mattered. It didn't matter.
Was it one person who approached her?
There have been quite a few over the years because she was in charge of social media for a long time.
Oh,
so she was handling Westboro's Twitter. And of course, because she had a phone, she was playing Words with Friends. And one of the people that really got through to her was just casually chatting with her. And one of the guys was from this Jewish organization. And then one of those guys was just this random guy who she ended up marrying, by the way, which is interesting.
Okay.
I feel like part of it is that they saw her as a person and liked her, but then they couldn't reconcile this person they liked with the things that she was saying and supporting them. And they would say that to her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm surprised that I like you, but these things that you're saying are crazy.
Yeah.
The other thing that really surprised me is that almost everyone that's involved, at least in the family, the Phelps family, they're almost pushed, forced into getting law degrees, medical degrees. They're very well educated.
Right, right.
They're educated at mainstream places. It's not just like an, you know, like
insular little
like Brigham Young where everyone goes. You know, it's very much like they were right next to other people who were different from them and it still didn't make a difference. Yeah. I was just having the hardest time even wrapping my head around how they've done that. But her aunt helped them win their Supreme Court case that proved they have the right to do what they're doing, basically.
What year was that?
Like 2016, 2013. It was really recent.
Uh-huh.
And I really thought.
Because that was after her dad died. I mean, her grandfather.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now he might have seen that happen. I could look up. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's really recent. I'm not sure if it's before or after Trump started, but I think she left the church in 2014. And she left with her sister. Part of it, too, she has this really close ties with her brothers and sisters. And I think at this point, two of them had become leaders in the church and started shutting her down, which is always what happens.
Yeah, right.
And then one of her sisters had left, one of her brothers had left, and then she had zero contact with them after. And so that was, I think, part of the unraveling,
too. So now she's back in contact with them?
She's back in contact with the people who left.
Right.
And even this book has a dedication to the rest of her family. Mm. Like, I hope we can talk again someday kind of thing. But she was allowed to go back and see her grandfather when he was dying the first day. And then after that, they figured out it was happening and they wouldn't let her go back.
Oh my gosh.
But the rest of the family was shunning him because there'd been kind of like a coup to take over the church by her brothers.
Was it money related or was it?
I mean, it's always money in the end, but control.
Right.
I think it's more about control.
Power, yeah.
Because the other thing that happened when the brothers took over is they started enforcing dress codes, and it's the women to cover up. But there's chat in Words with Friends.
Okay.
And so this is the place that everything broke down. Now, part of me is kind of sad that this is out in the world because I feel like if other fundamentalist religions read this book, their answer is just going to be, well, just don't let people on the internet. Right. Our people will be polluted through the internet.
Proven. Right. So just shutting down more means of contact.
Right. And I feel like their lack of understanding of how the internet worked in some ways I mean, they used it very well to their advantage.
Right.
But it really was the thing that let her stay connected to people who were out there.
How big is the church?
I'm not sure. It's grown. Like, people have joined it.
It's gotten bigger.
Interesting.
Oh my God.
Yeah, because it's not just the family anymore.
Right.
And I do think Trump probably has something to do with it.
Yeah.
But I do think there's something that's compelling to some people of that just like completely sure, you know, we believe this and this is us.
Yeah. Well, it feeds a narrative. So I'm not surprised that the Westboro Church is prospering and flourishing under that kind of mentality.
Yeah, no, and that's the kind of mentality that I grew up with. So seeing it explained in the way she was able to explain it was helpful to me because I just never seen it in quite those words. And I felt like, okay, if I could hand this to someone and they could understand a little bit more.
Right.
You know, because it does make you feel a little bit crazy. I think in some senses, though, what I wasn't seeing in the book, and I'm not sure if it's just because she doesn't have the gift of the perspective yet, like the time that hasn't passed, there wasn't a lot of how she's reconciling all of it. Because obviously she participated in really
horrible, awful
behavior. And I mean, it's kind of in there. I think there's also kind of a narrative of it not being her fault, which I also agree with to a certain extent. You know,
she was a kid.
Yeah. And I've been going around in circles about that a little bit.
Have you listened to the interview? I mean, she's been interviewed a lot of places, but Terry Gross did an interview with her.
Oh, and the book came out in hardcover.
And it's really revealing. I thought it was because she would ask that kind of question.
Okay. I'll go listen to that. I think a lot of people that leave that type of faith community, if you want to call it that, it feels like a cult to me, so that's how I think of it. But I think they all have to grapple with that. How much blame do you take on? How much guilt do you take on? Or do you just live your life from that point forward and just try to let it go?
It's not common for someone indoctrinated in one faith or way of thinking to switch.
It's really not. And part of the control in this book and in all the other situations is, especially when it's so family-based, you know?
Oh, I know.
Like, you leave your family behind? Who's going to leave their family behind?
I know. Well, that's...
I mean, I think it's a very compelling read. And I've started out, this is like November, 15th today? I started out November trying to read a memoir every day until I couldn't anymore. So this is when I finally got to
this. Okay. I do like memoir a lot, but it has to be the right kind of memoir.
I think. It's for nonfiction November. So.
Oh, good for you.
One more really amazingly surprising thing that I feel like if they ever reconcile this with themselves, I just don't know how they do. So Minister Phelps, whatever his name was, he was a civil rights activist. He would take on civil rights cases on the behalf of Black people and win them and champion their cause in the South.
But he wasn't actually feeling it, or he was just a brilliant lawyer?
They consider themselves civil rights activists.
So what?
Like,
so
racial.
What happened? Because they moved to they're in Kansas now, right?
Yeah. I mean, he'd won cases in, I don't want to misquote, but just in the South in general. Yeah. Like, he did this
work.
That
is unbelievable.
Yeah. And so that's part of the narrative that they make each other feel good about too, is that they were on the right side of history or whatever.
But do they think he was a little crazy?
Has anyone
discussed whether he was all
She
there?
Doesn't. Okay. I think you can tell there's definitely the sense of loyalty even in the book.
The
now.
Way she describes him. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not sure how other people see him.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely single-minded.
Because aren't there drugs involved too? Like,
I don't remember. There's abuse involved.
Uh-huh.
Like physical abuse.
Right,
he abused
right.
his wife for
oh,
sure.
Boy. Okay.
And her parents abused her.
Mm.
But you know, as
that's part of the
Bible-based punishment.
Yeah, right. No, exactly.
But they would talk about like bruises on their bodies when they went to school.
I work at a church also. It was before I worked there, it was protested by Fred Phelps or by his people, and they had the whole God hates signs and we were worried about physical safety of the minister. So
like you're going to the right kind of place.
I think we're remembering the coverage of him that they did talk about some kind of problem with drugs and it had to do with his sons also. And I'm sorry, I'm not quoting it right, but
I guess if she talked about it, I just didn't pay that much attention to it, but I don't remember much about it. I wouldn't be surprised. Like, you have to make money somehow, right? So, like, where does the money come
from?
Well,
yeah.
But anyway, overall, pretty powerful. I'd like to see what she's saying in 10 years. Because one thing I know from my background is that you don't realize that you're brainwashed until you can't get stuff out of your brain. Even the other day, I was having a conversation with someone, and I thought of a Bible verse as a response to her question. I was like, wow. where does it even come from?
So it's the self-realization that's what your brain's doing.
I mean, just how much of it you can't just get rid of because you've left it. Like, it's just still such a part of
right.
you. Right.
But know? Also the separation from that old self to say, oh, I'm thinking this thing. Isn't that
yeah,
weird that
it
I'm
is. Thinking it? Yeah. It's like, and so like, I feel like she still has a lot ahead of her. Just right. if I were basing it on my own experience.
Okay.
So I guess I'll just conclude that by saying it was worth reading. What is your
I'm
last book?
I'm definitely going to read it. Yeah. So my last book is Home Fire by Camilla Shamsie. It was published in, well, it was winner of the 2018 Women's Prize for Fiction, which I think is a British award.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. It used to be the Orange Prize, and then it was the Bailey's.
Okay.
And now it's just the Women's Prize.
You know all this stuff. So 2017, it was published, at least in this country. And it is a retelling of Antigone, which when I was getting ready for this podcast last night, I was reminded of, as far as I'm concerned, you don't need to know that. Like, I don't know the Greek plays anyway, but it didn't inform anything for me. So mm-hmm. if you haven't read Antigone, that is just fine.
Did you know before you read it though?
I did, but I was like, okay, well, okay. I mean, it's not like, what's that other book that just came out by that woman? Listen to me. So specific.
Circe.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So that, you know, is actually based on the Iliad.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Is and that the one? That's the one, right?
Yeah. And it's probably pretty important to know for that.
Exactly.
Like, it's like a different point of view.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So but this, the story is the same, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is just a retelling with a similar, like a parallel plot to Antigone. But it's about a Pakistani family that lives in England. And there's an older sister and then two twins, a brother and a sister. And their father was a terrorist, I think, and their mother has died. And so the older sister kind of raised them and kind of sacrificed her life for them. And then got an opportunity to become a scholar in somewhere, probably at Wellesley or some school in Massachusetts. And so she leaves. And in the meantime, her younger sister and brother, her brother gets radicalized by ISIS people and ends up in Pakistan or maybe Syria. I'm not sure exactly. I don't remember exactly which country he's in, but he leaves to go fight with ISIS. And the twin sister is left in England and she's very beautiful. And she takes up with the son of the minister. What do they call it? The home minister. It's like the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State, whatever the equivalent is in England. And because he's also Pakistani and his father has been able to rise above all this ethnic divide in England and, you know, is like kind of an everyman and he's a Muslim, but he's not like a devout Muslim. And he's seen as this great unifier. And his son is like the sort of playboy and, you know, very attractive. And so there's this romance between the twin sister and the son of the home secretary. That's the title. You never quite know whether she really loves him or she's just trying to use him to get a hold of her brother, because her brother becomes this national poster boy for radicalized Muslims who, you know, shouldn't, he wants to come back. He realizes he made a mistake. He wants to go back and they won't let him back. And then he's killed and then they won't let his body back. And so the twin daughter goes, and I think this is the part where Antigone really comes in.
That final scene.
The older sister becomes kind of like ancillary to this whole plot, but it's through her eyes, I think, that this whole story is told. It has an unbelievable ending. It's really gripping. My whole family read this book.
Oh, wow.
And I just highly recommend it. It's not a book that I read because the writing was so beautiful, although it is really good writing. It's just riveting. Have you read it?
I did.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I was talking like you hadn't.
No, it's fine. Because I don't think I ever talked about it on the podcast because I was so mad about the myth part because I didn't know that before I read it. So I read this novel.
Uh-huh.
And some of the behaviors of some of the characters didn't make sense to me.
Oh, okay.
And then I found out in like looking at other people's reviews because I was trying to make sense of it that it was based on the myth. I went and read the myth or the play or whatever. And then I came back to it and I was like,
oh dear. Because, so you didn't like it.
Well, I mean, I just, I was really interested in the characters on their own, like this brother who goes off and does this thing because his, you know, the relationship he had with his father is like so compelling. And this woman who's in this relationship that seems unlikely, but then they do things that I didn't make sense as much to me in the trajectory of their stories. And it is because it serves the points of this other story.
So she used that as like the skeletons of the story.
Yeah. And I was really interested for some reason in the relationship. Didn't the older daughter
She first met him, Eamon, in Massachusetts. They met, they were both in the same town.
But the way she wrote that, it felt like they had this chemistry.
Well, I think the older sister really felt for him.
Yeah.
But
I wanted
the
rest of that story.
Yeah, right. I know.
But I really, I mean, I it was my first book by this author, and you know, I'm trying to read more from Asia this year, and I have some other books on my list from her for Pakistan, but I haven't read them. I don't know if I'll get to them, but someday, because I would like to kind of read her backlist, because that was the first novel I'd heard of. Mm-hmm. Have you read any others?
No, I
liked her.
You know, I don't have as much time. I don't read as much as you do. I can't, it would never occur to me to like go dig around in her backlist unless I was like so...
Well, it's hard to find things written in from an actual person from Pakistan.
Yeah,
set in Pakistan. So that's part of it, I think. And of course, it makes sense for younger authors to be setting things in Pakistan since it didn't exist.
Right, exactly. Right.
Before a certain point.
Right, so. Well, also, she is a big deal in England.
Yeah.
She's barely known here.
Yeah. I think the only reason I knew about her is because she was on that list. I like to read lots of award lists.
Right.
Yeah, that was the reason I read it.
So what was the action that you didn't believe?
I think the funeral scene at the end in the park.
The very, very last scene.
Yeah, I was like, what is happening? Why is she doing this? And that's like straight from the original.
From the original. Okay.
Yeah. And like, if I had known that, I would have understood it more in like the tribute type sense.
Well, it's funny because it didn't occur to me. I guess I'm a sucker for a big ending.
Oh, okay.
And so the drama of it kind of...
You liked that part.
I did like it. I thought...
Yeah. I mean, it does make a point.
And she also tells it with great remove. I mean, it's very kind of... She makes it more powerful because she's not really telling you exactly what happened. She's just kind of giving you an idea.
Yeah.
And I think... That's very effective.
It is interesting to me too, just on the level of what makes people do such things, like the brother and the father.
The scenes where he's being welcomed into the, I guess they're terrorists, but like welcomed into that fold, and like how they draw him in, and then then he's theirs. You know, it's horrifying, but I would imagine it's accurate. I mean,
I think so. Still happens now, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
The cover is beautiful too. It's very striking.
It is a striking cover. I don't know what it's supposed to be though.
I'm not sure.
Looks like a rose maybe? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Well,
thank you for talking about that one.
Yeah, I
always appreciate a different perspective. So
I think you read it more critically than I did. I was just like sucking up all the adventure. And because I don't read books that are plot heavy very often. And or not like suspenseful plot heavy, you know. I like books that have lots of twists and turns and meanders and stuff, but I don't normally read ones that are like edge of your seat type things.
Well, and I think it's just happened to me too many times in the last few years where I'll read something and then only will I know that it's based on this other thing that I feel stupid. I feel like I should have picked it out.
I get it. I feel like that's not that important to know about this book.
Yeah, no, I think she could have used it as her like secret internal framing.
Exactly.
And then maybe we wouldn't even have to know.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
There's another one. I'm trying to remember what it was that I read it, and it's like, it's Hansel and Gretel. I was like, is it though? Come on.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, sometimes it's good. I have started this habit of not, if I hear about a book, either because it's on a best of list or whatever, or, you know, or it's a novel of author that I like, I won't read about it. I just want to be surprised when I open it up. So I won't read the flat copy.
You want the actual experience.
I want it to unfold. And it can really come back to bite you. I'll be like a third of the way in the book and I'll be like, oh, wait, is this what this is about? Like, I just don't even, it's amazing how the reviews or the flap copy can create an expectation that sometimes it's met and sometimes it's not.
My biggest pet peeve is when a blurb or something like that will call something hilarious.
Oh, I know.
And then it's not. And it's often, like, especially, like you said, you were going to talk about Milkman. I'm like, oh, one of the things that I really saw when I finished that book, and I didn't particularly care for it, mm-hmm. is all of these people who are from the UK calling it hilarious. And I'm like, where? I didn't find it to be funny at all.
I think I made this comment on your Goodreads review. I don't. Maybe Probably. It wasn't you. Maybe it was Lark. Just like seems to be like some goddess of Goodreads. I don't know, but she. But I listened to it after I read it, and listening to it, it is hilarious.
Okay, and I've heard the audio is really good.
It is.
I've thought
really
about
good.
Going back because I feel like it won the freaking Booker Prize.
I know.
I need to appreciate it.
I will. I will push back in favor of Milkman.
Does it have the Irish brogue and everything?
Unbelievable. Oh, and man. Like you, and you know, my husband is Irish. He didn't realize that until later in his life. But his both his parents are alive. He's adopted, both his birth parents are alive and married, and they live in Ireland. So we've gone over there. You know, obviously we've gotten to know them, and it's just remarkable to hear the Irish dialect, to hear it rather than read it. It's much more effective.
So I have a book that I read maybe a month or two ago, but I never talked about on the podcast. It's called Seven Necessary Sins for Women and Girls by Mona El-Tahawi. And I decided to talk about it because, it fits in with our themes, but also because I find myself recommending this to people more than any other book, which is crazy.
Great. Cool.
I remember a student in a health science class and someone at a celebration of failure that we had recently. And they said that we would have fewer failures if we overthrew the patriarchy, but does anyone know how to do that? And I was like, actually, this book. So she... It's the same person who wrote the book Headscarves and Hymens.
Oh my gosh.
Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. Okay. So she's always writing about women, especially in the Middle East. But in this book, she's writing about them in the Middle East, but also other places. And she identifies seven sins that need to be committed to dismantle power structures. We won't just call it the patriarchy. Anger, attention, profanity, ambition, power, violence, and lust. And so she talks about her own stories experiencing violence, and she has other examples. She is able to show how these things are structural in their perpetuity. She's very good at pointing out the United States blind spots in that we often see these things, violence against women, we talk about them as things that happen over there.
Right.
To these poor people who have to wear headscarves or whatever.
Right.
And we're like missing a lot of violence that's happening to us and around us in our own country, mm-hmm. which is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. She talks about how sexual violence in particular is used as a war tactic. And how double oppression is used in countries controlled by dictators.
Double oppression?
So like sexual violence and then lack of upward mobility.
Right,
so like it's like coming at you from both sides,
exactly,
basically.
Right.
She has specific examples of powerful men trying to silence teenage girls. And she used Greta Thunberg.
Oh, Trump.
Greta Thunberg as an example. But this was before the Trump thing happened.
Oh my gosh.
But I was reading it as that was happening. So apparently she's been threatened before by other powerful men, which I just didn't know. She wasn't on my radar.
In her country?
Yeah, I think so. And then in like the UK, I think.
Wow.
So she has a reputation, and online, just online, because she's active there. And so there's just a lot. She asks some really good questions. What does bodily autonomy really mean? What power would it give us to have it? Why are they so afraid? Yeah, that's a good one.
Mm.
What if women and girls were taught to use the power they have instead of how to suppress it? How's this question? I'm quoting this one directly. What if girls were taught they were volcanoes whose eruptions were a thing of beauty? That one's about anger. Like the chapter about anger is amazing, and about how women aren't allowed to express
it. Anger, yeah.
And then this one last quote I'll read. The most subversive thing a woman can do is talk about her life as if it really matters. I mean, it's just such a moving book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to read. At the same time, it was also uplifting.
Is it specific? You said it's specific, right? It gives examples.
Gives lots of really specific examples.
Because I think it sounds amazing, but I would need like...
Yeah, something to hold on to.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it reads more like...
manifesto?
Word? It's kind of like a manifesto. So maybe not specific examples about how to change it, but specific examples of how
what's happening right now.
Yeah, it's more of a reflection of how it's happening and the reasons we need to change it.
I will definitely read that. That sounds wonderful.
It's amazing. It's just so powerful. And that's why I can't stop telling people to read it. I ordered it from the library and I was going to bring it to our discussion, but someone already placed it on hold. Hopefully one of the people I told to read
good,
it.
Good.
I'm like, read it. Maybe I'll send this one to my sisters for Christmas. That sounds like a good older sister book. So this has been very interesting. What do you think you're going to read next? Or is there anything you're reading now?
Well, I brought what I'm reading right now. I just finished the new John le Carré. Like I'm not a big fan of his, but I've read like three of his books and I just came available at the library.
Was it his biography or?
No, like it's an agent running in the field. It's just, I don't know. It was a great airplane read. I don't read that kind of book, and I really was glad to read a book that was just purely action. So,
yeah,
I recommend it. I am reading less. Mm-hmm. And have you read this? Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying it. I'm finding it a little depressing because he's so beaten down. But I would say parts of this book are hilarious. Like, they made me laugh out loud. And I usually never laugh when I'm reading.
I'm surprised you waited so long to read it because it did win the Pulitzer.
Well, exactly. It improves my point that I love Pulitzer books, but it only came available to me just now. Yeah, and I think it had come available and I had to like let it go. And this is a large print edition. I love reading large print books. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. So awesome. I don't know what's going to happen to poor Arthur Less. But.
Oh, probably more of the same, right?
Do you ever listen to the New Yorker Fiction podcast?
Is there a separate one for fiction? Because I listen to, maybe I just listen to the New York Review of Books one.
I think it is separate because what they have is a modern day writer will read a story that appeared in the New Yorker by somebody else.
Oh, no, I haven't done that one.
And then he or she will talk to the editor, the fiction editor, about the story. And so Andrew Sean Greer, read a story by Dorothy Parker that was so dark and so funny. And then his conversation with the editor was just so entertaining. It made me realize how much I wanted to read this. So he's fabulous.
Well, and is this his first novel?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
He wasn't on my radar at all until this one.
I really am impressed. Yeah, he's the author of five works of fiction, including the bestseller, The Confessions of Max Tivoli.
Oh, wait, I've heard of that one. Okay. Yeah, great.
Oh, and I just finished The Dutch House Band Pageant, too. And
worth it?
Thumbs down.
Which
is too bad
because kind of goes up and down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I usually love her.
What I realized the other day, I get her confused with Barbara Kingsolver.
Right, right.
Because I'll start talking about the book with the oranges on it, and like that ends up being Barbara Kingsolver instead.
Oh, is that common? Well,
is that Anne Patchett or is that Barbara?
That's Anne Patchett. I haven't read that one. That's Commonwealth, right?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's Anne Patchett. I don't know. I don't know why I can't get them straight. Their names don't sound the same.
No, or anything. But they're both like writers that women love to read. Like,
yeah,
they have a huge following.
Who wrote The Signature of All Things?
That's the other one in that Gilbert. Elizabeth Gilbert. And I read her new book and actually I didn't read it because I couldn't get through it. It was sucky.
Oh,
the one about the bastard graduate. And
I've heard some just really some mixed response.
Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, it's probably not going to get me to pick it up. I actually have to reread a book this weekend. Jasmine Ward is coming here in February.
I saw that.
So excited. And so
Which one are you going to read?
Well, we're doing like this gradual book club where every month we're reading a different book of hers until she gets here.
Fabulous.
So we're starting with the newest one, which is Sing Unburied Sing. Right. I think I'm supposed to help lead discussions, so I really need to reread. So that's what my weekend is going to be. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for coming down here.
Yeah.
Thank you for talking books with me.
I love this. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Reading Envy, or find a complete listing of our podcast episodes, as well as all of the books discussed on today's episode at readingenvy.com.